Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Thursday, March 18th. Let's get straight to the news. The suspect arrested in the murder spree at the Three Spas in Atlanta has been charged. 21-year-old Robert Long faces 8 counts of murder and 1 count of aggravated assault. Police say he killed 4 people inside one spa, 3 people inside another, and 1 person inside a third. Officials say he was arrested while on the way to Florida to possibly carry out more attacks. 6 of the 8 victims were Asian women, leading to speculation that the spree may have been part of a rise in anti-Asian hate since the coronavirus pandemic. But yesterday, officials offered another possible motive.
The suspect did take responsibility for the shootings. He said that early on once we began the interviews with him. He claims that these, and as the chief said, this is still early, but he does claim that it was not racially motivated. He apparently has an issue, what he considers a sex conviction, and sees these locations as something that allows him to go to these places, and it's a temptation for him that he wanted to eliminate.
So obviously, whatever the motivation was for this guy, we know that many of the victims, the majority of the victims, were Asian. We also know that this is an issue that's happening across the country. It is unacceptable. It is hateful. And it has to stop.
Let's go right down to Atlanta. NBC News correspondent Blaine Alexander has been covering the story for us. Blaine, good morning. We know that 6 of the 8 women were Asian, killed inside these spas a couple of nights ago. What more did we learn at that briefing, and what have we known since then?
Well, Willie, good morning to you. We certainly learned a lot during yesterday's briefing. You heard from what some law enforcement officials say the suspect told them in the hours after he was taken into custody. Now, a couple of things that I do want to highlight that I think really kind of stood out yesterday. One was just the way in which he was captured. You know, we know that this kind of spread out over this stunning, almost 200-mile stretch. The suspect really did cover a lot of ground when you think about the 3 spas and then the fact that he was ultimately captured about 2 hours to the south of where I am. Now, I think one of the more chilling details is that he told investigators that when he was captured, when he was taken in, he was actually driving south toward Florida. He was headed to Florida essentially to continue his spree. By his own admission, he planned to hit some more places there. So the fact that he was taken into custody in a relatively short amount of time ultimately saved some lives in that instance. The other thing I want to point out is that you heard from Captain Jay Baker there with the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office saying what the suspect told him about his own mindset and what it was that led him to. Again, he has admitted to these crimes. He has accepted responsibility. So what he says led him to do these things. I want to also, though, highlight what Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms said right after that. Now, she was asked about the fact that, you know, perhaps this was some sort of temptation he was trying to eliminate. And she said, you know, one, we're not going to get into the place of victim blaming or victim shaming. But also, as far as the 2 businesses that were targeted here in the city of Atlanta, she says, to their knowledge, to Atlanta police knowledge, these were legitimate businesses. They didn't have any sort of complaints. They didn't have any major 911 calls against them. So they have no reason to have had them on their radar in the first place. I do think that's an important point to underscore. And then the final thing, as you mentioned, the motive, the question, what exactly was it that drove him to do this? Now, overnight, Atlanta police put out a rather strong statement, kind of underscoring the fact that they say it's too early to rule anything out. And that includes, of course, race being a possible motivator for this crime. You know, they said our investigation is still far from over and we are looking into every possibility. So, guys, as we start this day, there are still a number of questions. One, we know that he's going to be arraigned today. We're also looking to get the names of the other 4 victims, the other 4 people who were killed in this attack this week, Willie.
Yeah, Blaine, obviously, before we heard from the police, there was a lot of concern that this was a hate crime, given that six of the eight victims were Asian women. Those charges still could be on the table, as you point out. So what will authorities be looking at? What we have so far is the word of the alleged shooter, what he told the police. What more will police be looking at to determine whether this was a hate crime?
Well, I think a couple of things. You know that there is one survivor still, one man who is still in the hospital. We're told that he's in stable condition. I assume that they'll certainly be talking to him a lot to kind of find out what, if anything, the alleged shooter said when he walked into these places. Talking to other people who may have been involved as well to find out what was said and perhaps what was asked, anything like that. But also his background. I think they're going to be looking at that a lot, too. But again, investigators have said that, look, they have spoken with him, but they still have a long way to go in this investigation. So certainly a lot of things left to be answered, Willie.
All right. NBC's Blaine Alexander in Atlanta for us this morning. Blaine, thanks so much. Mika, also, as Blaine is talking about the pursuit of the shooter here, it was his parents who called him in. They saw on social media and on the news the images of his face as police had made those public. It was his parents who called him in.
We will follow this closely. We want to move to politics now. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced Democrats' plans to pass a comprehensive voting reform bill called the For the People Act.
We will put the bill on the floor. We will see if our Republican friends join us. If they don't join us, our caucus will come together and decide the appropriate action to take. Everything is on the table. Failure is not an option.
The package includes protections against gerrymandering, improved election security, and makes it easier to register to vote. The House passed its version of the bill earlier this month, with every Republican voting against it. Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia used his first floor speech to address the restrictive voting laws pushed by Republicans in the wake of his Senate runoff win. Here's part of his comments.
We are witnessing right now a massive and unabashed assault on voting rights, unlike anything we've ever seen since the Jim Crow era. This is Jim Crow in new clothes. Within 24 hours, we elected Georgia's first African-American Jewish senator, and hours later, the Capitol was assaulted. It is a contradiction to say we must protect minority rights in the Senate while refusing to protect minority rights in the society. Colleagues, no Senate rule should overrule the integrity of our democracy. And we must find a way to pass voting rights whether we get rid of the filibuster or not.
Senator Warnock received a standing ovation and cheers throughout the chamber when he finished his speech. And the senator will be our guest just ahead on Morning Joe. Let's bring in White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire. National political reporter for the New York Times, Elena Plott. Co-founder and CEO of Axios, Jim VandeHei. And White House correspondent for Politico and co-author of The Playbook, Eugene Daniels. He's also an MSNBC contributor. Good to have you all on board this morning.
Jim VandeHei, again, because we've been around Capitol Hill. I was around with you 25 years ago on Capitol Hill. We saw legislation passing more regularly then. But if you look just over the past 10 years, look at the last 6 years of the Obama administration and Donald Trump's 4 years, really the only significant piece of legislation that passed over that decade. Big piece of legislation was Trump's tax cut that helped a lot of billionaires. Is it possible to get legislation through this Senate or any Senate these days without some major restructuring of the filibuster?
I don't think it is unless one of the parties has some kind of dynamic election result and ends up with 60 plus votes in the Senate. Ever since we've moved to this period of politics where you don't really have moderates in either party, you have a couple, but you don't have nearly as many as they did sort of back when we were when you were in Congress and I was covering Congress. They're gone. So now the parties are so polarized and unified that it almost requires only having a 50 seat threshold if you want to get things done, unless you have a supermajority. And that's really the question that's facing Democrats. Like, it's staring them right in the face. Like, they know they can get this legislation on voting rights passed. They can get infrastructure done. They can get big chunks of the Green New Deal done if they get rid of the filibuster. It's still a big if, but they could. They could really re-engineer government in this country in the image that their base would love to have it re-engineered to comport with if they make that decision. The thing that sits in the back of their mind goes to your question, which is, okay, but if you keep flipping control, and we've had so many, we've had Republicans in full control, then Democrats, Republicans, right, then Democrats. What happens when you don't have power? Does all this stuff just get reversed, or they do unto us as we did unto them? And I think that we're going to know relatively soon. I think this is going to come to a head, because if you look at the language that you heard in that floor speech, Elizabeth Warren told us that the filibuster is rooted in racism. There's going to be a lot of pressure on Joe Manchin to say, get rid of the damn filibuster and let's do what we want to do, what they believe the voters sent them here to do. We'll see.
I mean, the filibuster has been around a couple of hundred years, but it certainly wasn't around at the very at the beginning of the Republic. So it's not like it's attached to the Constitution. But Jim, the choice is, do you want elections at this point? And again, I have always been a champion of the filibuster. I didn't like when Harry Reid got rid of it for federal judges. I didn't like it when Mitch McConnell got rid of it for Supreme Court judges. But nothing's getting done in Washington. When Mitch McConnell yesterday said, OK, well, if Democrats do that, when Republicans get elected, we're going to pass all of our priorities. We're going to toughen the border. We're going to pass gun law. And I thought, OK, well, great. Let's do that, because that would mean elections have consequences. Right now, elections do not have consequences because, as you said, there is no middle left in the Senate, and everybody is just blindly voting the way their party wants them to vote. And a great example of that, I was hoping we'd have this more moderate center that could get significant legislation done at the beginning, because there are moderates out there, conservative slash moderates. But you look at a bill that had 76% approval rating with the American people, had 56% approval rating with the Republicans. Not a single Republican voted for that piece of legislation. Not one. And they can't say that it spent too much money after their shameful record on deficits and debts and the size of budgets over the last 4 years. So nothing's going to get done. Elections are not going to have consequences if they don't do something significantly. So what does that look like, Jim?
I think what it would look like, they would have to be able to persuade Joe Manchin and other skeptical Democrats to go along with getting rid of the filibuster and doing exactly what you just said. Listen, there's been a lot of hypocritical nonsense around the filibuster for years. As you said, there's nothing in the Constitution about it. It's a Senate tradition, and that's how most Senate rules become constructed. And Democrats are going to sit there and ask themselves, like, how can Mitch McConnell write in the Wall Street Journal today that he's going to basically blow up the Senate if they do anything on the filibuster, when Mitch McConnell himself used the filibuster to make sure that the Supreme Court, one of the most powerful institutions in the world, looks the way it does today because he was able to block a Supreme Court nominee. And they're going to say, why don't we use that same power to get things done that we want to get done? And it's the only way they're going to get these big things done. You're not going to get all this nonsense about, oh, there's going to be so much bipartisanship around infrastructure. There isn't theory. There is not in practice. The minute you start talking about tax increases and you talk about the specific components, you're probably going to lose most, if not all, of the Republican Party. So if they want to get things done on voting rights, if they want to get things done on infrastructure, Joe Biden, Manchin, others are going to have to come to the conclusion that you're going to get rid of the filibuster. And that's what the vast majority of Democrats want to do. And by the way, I've always assumed that's what will happen. I think the pressure is so intense and the stakes are so high. And you look at what's happening in the states with voting rights, I think they're going to do it.
I think they're probably believing they have to do it. And Willie, politically, the political fallout will come from however the Republicans decide to act 2 years from now if they take the majority of the Senate. But what we have now are presidents who can't pass legislation. So they sign executive orders. And then the next president comes in and they sign executive orders that overturn the last president's executive orders. I'd like to see that. If that's going to happen, it might as well happen with legislation where actually the House and the Senate actually function the way they're supposed to function. And anybody, Willie, who believes that the American people are going to be shocked and stunned and deeply saddened with filibuster reform, or if they change the rules of the filibuster, that's process Americans aren't going to care. That's not what they're going to vote about 2 years from now. They're going to vote for the actual legislation that does get passed.
And that's exactly the argument that Minority Leader Mitch McConnell made, the one you're referring to a couple of days ago. It was posed as a threat, but what he was saying was, okay, if you want to do this, if you want to have a simple majority vote on major legislation, we can do that, but here's what we're going to do when we're back in power. Here's the minority leader 2 days ago.
Nobody serving in this chamber can even begin to imagine what a completely scorched earth Senate would look like. This is an institution that requires unanimous consent to turn the lights on before noon. Everything that Democrat Senates did to Presidents Bush and Trump, everything the Republican Senate did to President Obama, would be child's play compared to the disaster that Democrats would create for their own priorities if they break the Senate.
So, Elena, that was the threat from Mitch McConnell this week to Democrats. Say, if you go this way, we'll go that way as well. Democrats may say, we're up for that bargain. You know, people like Jim Clyburn saying civil rights legislation is too important. This H.R. 1 has to get through. So go ahead and get rid of the filibuster if we can. Where does that leave us? Where is this headed?
I think one of the most consistent themes I heard from Republican voters over the past 4 years, Willie, is that they, contrary to everything we've seen Mitch McConnell do on the Senate floor with regard to Supreme Court nominees or what have you, is Republicans consistently tell me that they don't believe their party fights in the way that Democrats do, that they're not unified in the way that, say, Harry Reid was able to keep Democrats unified. And to that, when Donald Trump himself was encouraging Mitch McConnell to eliminate the filibuster, I talked to a lot of Republican voters across the country who were in favor of that, which is to say that I think Senator McConnell is speaking to actually a shrinking number of Republicans who themselves see the value in the filibuster. As you all were pointing out, I mean, this really is a 50-50 country. And I think Republicans, however agitated they might be with the elimination of the filibuster now, they're ready for 2022 to get power back, because all of the things that Leader McConnell is threatening to pass in the event of a filibuster elimination, Republicans have been wanting for the past 4 years, which is to say, I don't think this would be, the last resort that some senators are making it out to be.
Yeah, senators would actually want this, right? Elena, senators, Republican senators, when they hear Mitch McConnell saying, oh, well, if we actually get rid of the filibuster, watch out, we're going to be able to pass tough legislation on border security. We're going to be able to pass tough legislation regarding carry permits and making things reciprocal. I would think most Senate Republicans would say, OK, well, good. Let's do that. And we can actually pass legislation and then campaign every 2 years or every six years on what we got done instead of what the president signed on in an executive order.
Well, the thing is, Joe, even if Senate Republicans aren't willing to say that explicitly, their voters will be saying that. As I said, I can't tell you how many Republican voters I've spoken to in the past 4 years alone who believe that their party is never up to the challenge when it comes to legislation, that Senate Republicans like Mitch McConnell play to the base and stoke the anxieties of the base and the desires of the base to get into office only to achieve power and do next to nothing. So again, it's not just Democratic voters who are going to be calling their senators in the next few years, you know, hoping for a reform of this measure of some sort. It's going to be the right as well. And Senate Republicans are going to have a plan on how to respond to that pressure.
House Majority Whip Congressman Jim Clyburn called out the moderate Democrats who are seen as protecting the filibuster. In an interview with Politico, Clyburn said, quote, "We've got 50 Democrats. Warnock and Ossoff are two. Since when did Sinema and Manchin get to be more important than Ossoff and Warnock?" He went on, "They all got us to 50. So this whole notion that we've got to do what Manchin says, Warnock is up in 2 years for re-election." Eugene Daniels, your thoughts.
You know, that's the thing that I continue to hear from voting rights advocates. Over the last couple of years, they started to talk about this more as an issue of making sure that Black and Brown people have the rights to vote. This the issue of the filibuster, right? And, you know, Black people got Joe Biden in office. He has talked about that. He's talked about owing them. Black women bolstered Warnock and Ossoff in Georgia. They are the reason, Black voters are the reason that there is a 50 vote and with the vice president of 51 tiebreaker in the Senate for Democrats. And so what I continue to hear is that you either protect the filibuster, you protect this kind of arcane rule, like Joe said, voters don't really care about, and that's not what they're going to vote on, or you fight, you get voting rights passed, HR1, HR4, another one, which is the John Lewis Voting Rights Act that's coming down the pike. You either protect the rights of Black and Brown voters in this country, and that is what they are telling, and that's the pressure that Senate Democrats, including Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, are going to continue to get. And I think, you know, at some point they're going to have to make that decision, especially as we start to see, and I assume that Chuck Schumer is going to start throwing a lot of things on the floor and see Republicans obstruct, see Republicans actual filibuster, and then they can point to that evidence and say, you know, this is why we have to get rid of this, because they are showing that they don't want to, like Joe said, govern.
And what a sharp contrast. You look at how dynamic the United States of America has been over the past 20 years. You look at the IT revolution. You look at everything that's been happening. And then you contrast that with what Washington's looked like for the past 20 years. And it's just, it has, Jonathan Lemire, I know Joe Biden is a traditionalist, but this ain't 1974. This isn't even 1994 or 2004. If Joe Biden, the president, wants to get anything done, if Republicans that are in the Senate want to get anything done when they're in the majority, they're going to have to do something dramatic to make sure that 50 plus one wins the day in the United States Senate. And yes, that's for Republicans as well as Democrats. That's for conservatives as well as liberals. Yeah, it's just not working again when over the past decade, the only major piece of legislation to pass through the House and the Senate and get signed by a president was Donald Trump's tax for billionaires, tax cuts for billionaires. So where's Biden on this? Where does he move? Is he going to call Joe Manchin in at some point and Kristen Sinema and ask if they can help get this job done so they can actually pass legislation over the next few years?
There's an extraordinary amount of pressure building on President Biden now to do something big, Joe. We have seen him, of course. We know Joe Biden. He was in the Senate for nearly four decades. He's an institutionalist. He believes in the traditions of the body. And certainly he has said himself, and aides around him have said, it is his preference in a perfect world to keep the filibuster intact. But there's a recognition that that's not going to be the case. We've reported there's been an intensive lobbying campaign from Democratic organizers, from lawmakers on the Hill, to West Wing aides, to Chief of Staff Ron Klain in particular. to try to move the president on this. We heard him yesterday in his interview with George Stephanopoulos for the first time sort of open up some wiggle room, the suggestion of the talking filibuster, which probably doesn't go far enough, but it's his first time where he would move. He has shown some willingness to move on the issue. He has, indeed, his aides know this, momentum after passing that COVID, massive COVID relief bill. Momentum he is trying to further by hitting the road, as the show opened today, noting. But that momentum won't go anywhere if they can't pass more legislation. And they can, as much as they can just paint the Republicans as the opposition to progress, whether it be about voting rights or about a tax increases on the wealthy, that's not going to fly with a lot of Democrats. A lot of Democrats, and particularly those who helped put Joe Biden in office. And the president and the vice president will be in Georgia tomorrow, almost to promote the COVID relief bill, sure, but also as a thank you to the voters who helped deliver the Senate to Democrats because of those two runoffs. Certainly, Voting Rights Act legislation is going to be discussed, but that can only happen if things change in the Senate. The pressure is building. Biden's not willing to move yet, but aides suggest that down the road, he may be.
He may have to. My old saying in politics, what I said I always noticed was nobody stops you when you're going 80 miles an hour. Well, the president's administration started at 80 miles an hour. They passed a historic piece of legislation, and things are going to slow down and stop for the next year and a half unless they figure out some way to be able to pass pieces of legislation like H.R. 1 and other pieces of voting rights legislation, infrastructure bills, and things that actually Americans will care about. Elena, we've heard, and really the piece of legislation that we're probably talking about here, if we move past the filibuster, or if there's something that moves the Senate past the filibuster, is H.R. 1. We've heard Democrats talk about how important that is for voting rights, to take care of gerrymandering, to take care of a lot of things. But we've also heard Republicans like Mike Lee calling it a piece of legislation, I think, from the depths of hell that Satan himself drafted. I did not know that Satan was into legislative drafting, but there you go. Mike Lee says that he is. So what have you heard? Is there any chance that any Republicans would support H.R. 1 and the voting rights reforms, or are they going to be lockstep against that? And if so, what do they fear the most about that bill?
It's a great question, Joe. At this moment, I have no reporting to suggest that any Republican in the Senate would be on board with this bill. And this is the reason why. So I was just in Texas the past 2 weeks, covering the Republican Party there. Governor Greg Abbott on Monday introduced a raft of quote unquote election integrity bills. I cannot emphasize enough how for state Republican parties across this country, election integrity, the continued entrenched belief that the election was either stolen from Donald Trump, which is, of course, untrue, or that there were multiple irregularities that the system has to deal with, the extent to which that is animating the GOP base right now. Any Senate Republican who signs on to a bill that would, be able to suggest that Democrats have more of a control over the electoral process in this country than many Republican voters believe they already do is going to be the death knell, I think, for any Republican elected official or any Republicans seeking office. As I said, this is, in Texas at least, the number one issue for the state Republican Party, beyond abortion, beyond further tax cuts, anything like that. So with the momentum for Republicans continually behind this issue, there's little to no incentive for a Senate Republican to sign on for it. And I would add too, Joe, that, should this bill pass, Republicans are going to have to be very careful with how they message about it and the damage that they are saying now that it could do to American democracy or the electoral process. Because already, as we saw in Georgia, but as I still continue to see when I talk to voters, Donald Trump's rhetoric that elections in this country are entirely broken, that you can't count on the outcome, has dissuaded a lot of Republican voters from already saying they will never vote again. There's increasing data to back that up. It happens in conversations when I talk to voters. I was at a Texas GOP rally a couple of weeks ago where a voter spoke to me and said, I will never vote in another election again. It's totally rigged. echoing Donald Trump's rhetoric explicitly. And again, to the extent that Republicans message against a bill like this and say it will ruin elections as we know it, that's a double-edged sword for them right now, and they're going to have to be careful.
Eugene Daniels, finally, what are you working on today?
We're working on today at Playbook. lots of things, but we have kind of an exclusive and some scoops on what Ron Klain told progressives behind the closed doors. Leaders of the Congressional Progressive Caucus met with White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain just yesterday morning. And Representative Jayapal actually talked to Rachel Bade on Wednesday night and talked about what they're looking at, the Build Back Better plan, talking about that progressives wanted a commitment from Ron Klain and President Biden that it doesn't just look at transportation, but looks at climate change and health care and family infrastructure, paid family leave, things like that. And Jayapal said we can either go green or we can go bipartisan, because I just don't think that Republicans are ready to have a transformative package. And so I said that at the White House is what she told us. And Klain didn't say what the plan was, how they're going to tackle this next step, this Build Back Better infrastructure plan. But they're exploring different options. They're talking about the possibility of breaking up the package in as many as three bills. And that's according to Congresswoman Jayapal.
All right. Thanks to you all, Jim Vandehei, Lena Plott, and Eugene Daniels. Thank you very much for being on this morning. And still ahead on Morning Joe, the head of Homeland Security gets grilled by lawmakers over what's going on at the southern border, plus the first high-level meeting between U.S. and Chinese officials will take place in Alaska today. We'll talk about what's at stake ahead of those talks. But first, let's go to Bill Cairns with a check on the severe weather that swept across the country. Bill?
Yeah, good morning to you, Mika. Yesterday could have been so much worse. It was bad, but the setup could have been horrific. We had 23 tornadoes reported, all the red dots, mostly Mississippi and portions of Alabama. And we had areas that were hit, but we only had a couple injuries, no fatalities, amazingly. And we haven't really seen pictures of like whole towns taken out. Now, this Billingsley, Alabama tornado was one of the stronger ones, and we had some significant damage. I mean, look at that SUV. That's the front of the car there. So the hood was ripped open. One of the doors was almost ripped off the car. So that was a very strong tornado. But again, a lot of people did get to shelters. There's going to be a lot of cleanup today, and we're not done yet. So let's go to the map. We still have one tornado watch and even one tornado warning around Dothan, Alabama. These storms are going to roll through Panama City. And then this afternoon, this line of storms is going to re-intensify. And we think the Carolinas have the best chance of seeing additional severe weather, 26 million people at risk. We could have additional tornadoes. So for all of our friends from Savannah to Charleston to Augusta, Georgia, Columbia to Myrtle Beach, Wilmington, Fayetteville, all through areas of eastern North Carolina, you're the area of greatest concern. And for anyone traveling today in the Northeast, we're also going to have a lot of heavy rain. Watch for significant airport and travel delays from Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York City, and Boston. We could see as much as 2 inches of rain in and around New York City. So again, we'll continue to watch our severe weather outbreak on day two today. Yesterday, somehow, maybe the luck of the Irish, we made it through it unscathed. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
The U.S. will not outcompete China with short-term legislation and never-ending uncertainty. That's another great argument for not trashing the legislative filibuster. Imagine if every action the Senate takes with national security implications were constantly subject to being wiped clean. While China plans years and decades at a time, our federal legislation would reduce to a shelf life of a couple of years.
That was Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell yesterday making his case for the filibuster and bipartisan legislation to curb China's growth. It comes as tensions are riding high ahead of the Biden administration's first face-to-face meeting with senior Chinese officials today in Alaska. Joining us now, President of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book, The World, A Brief Introduction, Richard Haass, and former ambassador to Sweden under President Obama, Mark Brzezinski. He served on the National Security Council staff under President Clinton as director of Russia and Eurasian Affairs. Good to have you both this morning.
Richard Haass, what should America want to get out of this meeting? What should we expect to come of this meeting?
Well, the answer to the second question, Joe, is not a lot. This is a relationship that, on one hand, it's the most important relationship of this era, but it's deteriorating at a fairly significant pace. And each side seems prepared to stake out fairly maximal positions. Indeed, they can't even agree that this is a strategic dialogue. The two sides can't even agree whether this is a one-off or there's going to be follow-up meetings. It takes place in the context of profound differences. The U.S. is obviously unhappy with what's going on in Hong Kong, with what we call a genocide against the Uyghurs, unhappy with the role of the continuing expanded role of the government in the Chinese economy, unhappy with muscular Chinese foreign policy against Taiwan in the South China Sea. China, meanwhile, is unhappy with all of our criticisms and our sanctions. The real question is whether we can build a floor under this relationship, begin to have a much better understanding about what each side can live with, and begin also to see, and this is optimistic, whether we can carve out at least some limited areas of potential cooperation, say on dealing with North Korea or climate change or global health.
Mark, you told us that before that, you'd quoted Henry Kissinger, who said we are in the foothills of the Cold War. Are we moving toward a Cold War? Are we actually in a Cold War? And if you could explain to our viewers how this relationship with China, even if we are in the so-called foothills of a Cold War, is far different than our showdowns with the Soviet Union post-World War II.
Well, thank you, Joe and Mika, for having me. No question, with the arrival of President Biden, the demonizing rhetoric from the American side has diminished. But I'm not sure we're at the problem-solving stage yet. And this is what's so exciting about today's meeting in Alaska, because in certain ways it represents a generational change. Two leading minds of Democratic foreign policy, Tony Blinken, Secretary of State, and National Security, Jake Sullivan, really represent generational change. Young guys in their 40s and 50s sitting down with Chinese counterparts, as Richard said, the most important geopolitical relationship the U.S. has. And on the one hand, Chinese-U.S. relations are at the lowest point ever in the modern era. On the other hand, the U.S. and China need each other. We need each other to be able to solve climate change, to stabilize the global economy, even to solve corona. So the question will be, will the outcome of today's meeting provide opportunities after probing, each side probing, are there areas that we can work together while at the same time agreeing to disagree on key things as well?
Sounds like there's a lot at stake. Want to move to Russia now. Russia recalled its ambassador to the U.S. amid rising tensions between the two countries. The foreign ministry made the announcement yesterday without providing a reason why. But the move came after this answer from President Biden when asked about the intelligence report that said Russia again interfered in the 2020 election.
Vladimir Putin authorized operations during the election to denigrate you, support President Trump, undermine our elections, divide our society. What price must he pay?
He will pay a price. We had a long talk, he and I. I know him relatively well. And the conversation started off, I said, I know you and you know me. If I establish this occurred, then be prepared.
You said you know he doesn't have a soul.
I did say that to him, yes. And his response was, we understand one another. I wasn't being a wise guy. I was alone with him in his office. That's how it came about. It was when President Bush had said, I've looked in his eyes and saw a soul. I said, looked in your eyes, and I don't think you have a soul. And looked back at me and said, we understand each other. Look, most important thing dealing with foreign leaders, in my experience, and I've dealt with an awful lot of them over my career, is just know the other guy.
So you know Vladimir Putin. You think he's a killer?
Mm-hmm. I do.
So, Mark, as an ambassador yourself, recalling an ambassador, what's the message that's being sent there? And what do you make of the president's pretty clear description of his relationship with Vladimir Putin?
Well, Mika, in diplomacy, there is no stronger message that can be sent than a leader of a country pulling back their personal representative to another country. And that's what Russia has done here. And I think I love what President Biden did with President Putin. He spoke truth directly to the eyes of this former KGB officer and said clearly, I understand you. That is the benefit to the American people of having a president who has been in the foreign affairs game for decades and decades. And I think it also, that kind of show of strength will be resonating among the Russian people as well. It's important to remember that the human rights leader, Alexei Navalny, has been put basically into what it was the former Soviet gulag in the farthest reaches of the Russian prison system. And many opposition leaders turned out to be successful democratic revolutionaries after they were put in jail. And I think this is part and parcel of a message to Putin. Be careful how you act going forward.
Richard Haass, the Associated Press's Jonathan Lemire has looked into your eyes and seen your soul, and he's going to tell you what he saw right now. Jonathan.
Unfortunately, I saw the soul of a Yankee
fan, so
that's sort of the same with Putin. So let's talk, Richard, about indeed the President Biden's. Let's talk about President Biden's rather strong rhetoric about his Russian counterpart. Certainly a marked break from what President Trump used to, how he used to refer to Vladimir Putin. What sort of message does it send? But more than that, Biden said yesterday in that interview, but of course, there has moments where we have to work with Russia. And he highlighted the New START nuclear deal, which has gotten done. Both sides wanted to get done. You on the show have said how important that was. What next has to happen, though? What is the next step of that relationship to be productive? In other words, what also is holding President Biden back at this point from even tougher rhetoric, from perhaps tougher measures against Russia?
It's a good question, Jonathan, particularly for a Red Sox fan. On the upside, there's not an awful lot, possibly something on North Korea, possibly something on Iran. With Russia, though, unlike China, it's more simply the avoidance of negatives. We've nailed down the single most important thing, which is the nuclear arms agreement. One question is whether you can expand what it covers over time. But really, what you want to do is limit what Russia does in Europe, what they're doing in Ukraine, what they're doing in Georgia. You don't want them to challenge NATO countries directly. We want to limit their really brazen use of force in Syria. So in a funny sort of way with Russia, you've got a freer hand than you have with China. Russia's not a great power in terms of economic reach. It's got, one-tenth the population of China. It's a more limited challenge. So with Russia, we actually have a freer hand. We're not as involved with them around the world. But again, what's so interesting to me here, as with China, there's real limits to our influence on the human rights and political question. Both countries are pushing back against us. We're talking about it more, but whether we actually bring about results in either China or Russia, I think is a real long shot.
Richard Haass and Mark Brzezinski, thank you both for coming on the show this morning. We really appreciate it. A lot going on. Coming up, Congress will hold a hearing today on hate crimes against Asian Americans during the pandemic, something the White House says has been fueled by previous administration. We'll talk to one of the lawmakers who will be testifying today. Morning Joe is coming right back.
I think there's no question that some of the damaging rhetoric that we saw during the prior administration, blaming, you know, calling COVID, you know, the Wuhan virus or other things, led to, you know, perceptions of the Asian American community that are inaccurate, unfair, have raised, you know, threatening, has elevated threats against Asian Americans. And we're seeing that around the country.
That is White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki arguing that former President Trump's rhetoric has played a role in the increased violence seen against the Asian American community over the last year. In just a few hours, the House Judiciary Committee will hold a hearing on that rise in hate incidents against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. Several members of Congress will speak at the hearing, including our next guest, chair of the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus, Democratic Congresswoman Judy Chu of California. Also joining us, NBC News correspondent Jo-Ling Kent. Good morning to you both, Congresswoman. I want to hear about the hearing today, but first, the state of the problem. Joe, you've been reporting on this at some length and in some depth. So just let's pause for a moment and look back at the last year and talk about, in a statistical way, how bad this problem is right now.
Hey, Willie, good morning. You know, although we don't know the motive, and investigators say it's too early to tell, you can say that the pain in the Asian American community nationwide right now is being felt because of the data and everything that we're seeing play out on the streets across America. And if you take a look, nearly 3,800 incidents of AAPI hate and harassment incidents have been reported since March 19th. And if you look at who's being affected, this is really where it hits home for so many of us. Nearly 70% of all reported incidents are being reported by women. That's more than twice as many as men who are reporting these incidents, and certainly doesn't even take into account all of the people who are not reporting, right? And as you dig a little further into the data from Stop AAPI Hate, you also see that a lot of this is happening about 35% of the time, happening at businesses. And so when you look at this full picture, you can see why there's so much stress and anxiety about this issue, even though there hasn't been a direct causal link determined officially yet. And we also know that so many women, Asian American women in particular, are facing this stress because there's a long history of misogyny and sexism and racialized sexism in these instances here, Willie.
Congresswoman, we've seen incidents here in New York City. I know you see them in California all too often of people, many of them elderly Asian Americans, being sucker punched, things like that, being spit on, being blamed for the coronavirus spreading across the country. So what message do you hope to get across at the hearing today?
Well, we want to make sure that the people know that we are condemning these acts of violence and that we have to stand together. Our hearts are still broken about the murder of eight people in Georgia, eight of them being in these Asian spa businesses and six of them being immigrant Asian women. But actually, this day was coming because it's been a whole year of ugly rhetoric by Donald Trump, who used the word China virus, Wuhan virus, and even Kung Flu to describe COVID-19. And we saw a spike recently in places like New York and in California, ugly actions against the elderly and the more vulnerable, including an 84-year-old Thai man who was assaulted and murdered in San Francisco, a 91-year-old man who was assaulted, pushed to the ground in Oakland Chinatown, and in my own city, a man who was beaten with his own cane and then lost part of his finger. So we need to bring attention to this so we can stand together to combat anti-Asian hate crimes.
So as you say, the first step is awareness, to let people know how serious the problem is. And that's what you're doing here. That's what Joe is showing us as well. What is the next step, though? So much of this is based on, frankly, ignorance and bigotry. What do you do about that problem so that we don't see as many victims as we've seen in the last year?
Well, we have been working double time on federal solutions. One thing that gave us so much gratification is that President Biden, within 1 week of taking office, issued the executive order for the Department of Justice to work with the Asian American community on solutions. We, in fact, have already met with them and are working towards some steps that could combat hate crimes. We are also urging the passage of the No Hate Act, which would vastly improve the hate crime reporting and the programs that combat it. Our hate crime reporting in the United States is very faulty because our federal government relies on local law enforcement to come forth with those statistics. But local law enforcement varies quite widely as to whether they actually have programs such as this, and this act would help to implement it. And then we are calling on a national day to speak out against hate on March 26th so that our nation can show that it wants to stop these anti-Asian hate crimes.
Joe, on a practical level, what are you seeing as you cover this story? What are people looking at doing to help stem this terrible tide?
Willie, I've been talking to activists and leaders in the community, and I think one thing that really stands out is that for the first time, a lot of this racism against our community is actually being talked about. And that's a huge first step in acknowledging the problem, is putting it out there on the table. And as the Congresswoman says, you know, this is now being elevated to the highest levels of government. You see the vice president talking about it, the president talking about it, but you also see it as a major, very key topic in pop culture. You have some of the biggest athletes and celebrities stepping forward to say, no, this is not okay. And in fact, it's been happening long before just the coronavirus pandemic since last March. It's been happening for years and for generations. And so when you look at what the community is doing, you not only see community support efforts like people escorting elderly Asian Americans just to run their daily errands, but you also see very powerful voices saying, we need to do more. And here are some of the steps that need to be taken in order to eliminate this. And also to acknowledge the history of what we know to be extremely painful, extremely biased, extremely racist. And so I think that's also a really important thing to be monitoring as we look at this issue is how are people talking about it? What kind of language should we be using? And how do we heal as a country and as a community here in the face of such a tragedy? Because as the Congresswoman said, this, a lot of people saw this coming.
Yeah, and that acknowledgement of the problem is the first step. It's where we are. Let's see where we go from here. NBC's Joe Lincoln, Congresswoman Judy Chu will be watching that hearing very closely today. Thank you both for being with us. Coming up here on Morning Joe, the Senate's number two Democrat, Dick Durbin, and Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia will be our guests. Plus, President Biden and Democrats are actively promoting the COVID relief package they passed. VA Secretary Dennis McDonough will join us on how the plan helps veterans specifically. We're back in just 90 seconds.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.